obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Thank you. I'm Patty. I'm an alcoholic. I'm grateful to be sober. I'm grateful to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've had a really good time right up until now. This is like your sobriety countdown is longer than most meetings I go to. I had to go to the bathroom 3 times during the opening ceremony. I'm about ready to go again right now. I'd like to thank Kathy and for inviting me, and Donna and John for hosting me. I'm a crappy hostess E. I don't host as well. I play ditch the host most of the time. I like sitting up here, my dealer sitting at the table with me. Anna was my dealer Friday night, and wish I'd have gotten at least one blackjack, but I think every time I talk, I'm going to ask the Mary Lynn Choir to open for me. I love... I'm a Mary Lynn Choir groupie. I've followed them to Sacramento. I would follow them anywhere. If you haven't gotten their CD, I encourage you to buy a couple of them. It's just tremendous work that you do, and I really appreciate you being here. My sponsor always tells me when I have an opportunity to do this, I have 2 major responsibilities. I should tell you my name, and I should tell you the truth. I've told you my name. I'm not so sure I'm going to tell you the truth. And the reason for me for that is pretty simple. I didn't know when I was out there, I didn't know that what it used to be like was going to be important. If I would have known when I was out there that I would be here today reporting to you what it used to be like, I would have paid more attention to my life. But I didn't know what it was like was going to be important, so I didn't pay a lot of attention. In fact, if I had known I was going to be here, I would have taken notes. If I would have known about steps 4 and 5, I can guarantee you I would not have done some of the things that I did. But I didn't know it was going to be important, so I didn't pay a lot of attention. Coupled with that, I'm a blackout drinker. I love blackouts. I love blackouts. I wish we could have blackouts sober. There's nothing more exciting for me than leaving work on July 1st, going back on July 5th, and discovering you've been there the entire time. It makes the time between paychecks so much shorter. I love blackouts, but if you're not paying a lot of attention to your life and you're a blackout drinker, it makes what it used to be like a little fuzzy. So a lot of what I report to you has been reported to me by other people. And I just have to believe they're telling me the truth. Coupled with that, I have a job. I had to get a fingerprint clearance for my job. I fingerprint really, really well. I am good at fingerprinting. I roll right along with the printer. I don't resist it. I don't go too fast. I just roll right along. And I was being printed for my job. I didn't want to raise any red flags, so I said very casually to the woman doing my printing, I said, well, how far back are you going to check? And she looked me in the eye and said, from the day you were born. And I thought, oh, my God, it's like a fifth step, only it's in the wrong order because they're going to know about it before I do. And the book Alcoholics Anonymous says more will be revealed. It doesn't say how. So I don't know if many of you have relationships with non-alcoholic people, but non-alcoholic people, when they're going to give us what they think is bad news, they tend to have a hesitancy in their voice. And this woman called me, and she was really hesitant when she said, your report came back. And I said, uh-huh. She said, normally these reports are 2 or 3 pages long. I said, uh-huh. She said, yours was 56 pages. Do you want to see it? Well, of course I did. So I ran down there and I read that report. And I can tell you this, I know a lot more about what it used to be like having read that report than I did before then. So I don't know if this story is true or not, but I like the story, so I just keep telling it. And here's how it goes. I didn't have my first drink of alcohol until I was 13 years old. And I'm really sorry I waited that long. But I had absolutely no idea what alcohol would do to me or for me. I don't remember ever thinking I can't wait until I drink. I certainly never thought I would never drink, but I didn't think about alcohol at all. And yet I'm 13 years old. I'm on a camping trip. We're camped just south of Oceanside on the beach. I remember that Friday night as if it were tonight. I remember getting into that tent, and in my pillowcase, I had a bottle of vodka. To this day, I don't know where that bottle came from. I have always believed it was the grace of God, but I've never been able to confirm that. I had absolutely no idea what alcohol would do to me or for me, but I remember having a sense of ease and comfort when I took that bottle out of my pillowcase. And the book Alcoholics Anonymous talks about that we get a sense of ease and comfort before we even take the drink. And I asked if anybody wanted any of that vodka, and they didn't. And the reason they gave me for not wanting it was all we had to mix with it was grape soda and root beer. And I said, so what? And I took off the top, and I drank half the bottle. And I looked around the tent. Nothing had gotten different. Nothing had changed. So I drank the second half of the bottle. And that was to be the end of my social drinking. Never again after that day did I ever offer anybody a drink out of my bottle. And I don't know about anybody else in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I never got resentments until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I never had resentments out there, but one of my early resentments in Alcoholics Anonymous is I heard you talk about your first drink, and you described it, and you talked about this warmth in your mouth, and you talked about how it felt as it went down your throat, and you somehow tracked it as it went down and it got to your stomach and it exploded, and it went to your fingernails and your toenails, and you grew a couple inches and you dropped 20 pounds and your pimples fell off and wonderful things happened to you. And that simply wasn't the case for me. I had my first drink of alcohol and absolutely nothing happened to me for about 15 minutes. And at the end of the 15 minutes, the only thing that happened to me was I had to go to the bathroom. And it's my belief this morning that if you were to drink a quart of anything in about 15 minutes, you'd have to go to the bathroom. So I got out of the tent. I shuffled through the sand to the outhouse. I went in and went to the bathroom. And when I got done and went to get up, I realized I was absolutely and totally 100% paralyzed to the toilet seat. I couldn't move. I couldn't even blink. I didn't feel my heart beating. And I was overcome with a sense of fear. And, of course, the fear was that somebody else was going to have to come use that outhouse. And there I was, paralyzed to the toilet seat. Now, later in my drinking, I would discover that two people can use the same toilet at the same time. It's a visual. It really. But the second person has to be very careful about what they're doing. But I didn't know that at 13, but I did somehow know that the body was made up of energy. And I somehow figured if I could gather my energy, I would be all right. So I've always referred to it as my first formal meditation, because I sat and I gathered my energy. And when it seemed to be in one place, when it seemed to be centrally located, I just sort of fell off the toilet, out the door, into the sand, and started crawling back to the tent. Now, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, you explained to me that my entire problem that night was my attitude. If my attitude would have been right, I could have had a fantasy. I was in the Marines. I was being dive-bombed as I was trying to get back to safety. And if my attitude would have been right, it could have been a wonderful experience. Now, in my own defense, I always have to tell you, my pants were still down at my ankles. I had started to get sick. I couldn't quite get through it. I couldn't get around it. And I've always contended under those circumstances, it's a little difficult to have a good attitude. I did somehow manage to get back to the tent. I fell in and I passed out. And when I came to in the morning, I realized nobody was in the tent with me, and I couldn't figure out where they went until I realized I'd been sick all night long. I'd hit the top of the tent, the side of the tent, like you've never been sick. I hadn't missed a square inch, and quite frankly, I didn't want to be in the tent either. So I got out of there, and that was my first drink of alcohol. And it was the most amazing, fabulous, magnificent, wonderful, incredible, marvelous spiritual experience I'd ever had. And it must have been because I put some amount of alcohol into my body from that day until the day I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't always get drunk, and I didn't always drink the kinds of things that you would classify as a beverage. I drank a lot of vanilla extract. I used to buy it by the six-pack. I just recently found out they make vanilla extract without alcohol in it anymore, which I think is a total ripoff for our children. But I remember the day the guy at the market called me over. He said, Patty, I can't let you buy vanilla extract anymore. He says, I can't believe anybody bakes as much as you do. And I got cut off from that supply, drank a lot of mouthwash. I drank a lot of perfume. Taboo became my after-dinner drink of choice. I'm telling you, I still have a weakness. If you're wearing it, I may follow you too closely and lap at your neck. And you know, you wonder, how do we know about that kind of stuff? My next-door neighbors who are not alcoholic, they've been to my house a few times. They have never once eaten or drank a single thing out of my bathroom. But we just sort of intuitively know that stuff. Now, I'm a bar drinker. I'm a living room drinker, a backyard drinker, a car drinker, an office drinker, an alley drinker, a dumpster drinker. I don't really specialize. I just drink. But I love bars. I love sleazy, nasty, disgusting bars. And you probably don't have any in the South Bay. But I'm going to tell you what they're like. They're like those seedy places with sawdust on the floor. The mirrors are cracked, so you kind of have to dip around to see yourself in there. Posting around the bar is ripped, or people have tried to hold on as they're falling off the bar stool. It's always nice if there's a piece of broken furniture in a corner somewhere. And they used to be full of smoke. I understand you can't smoke in a bar in California anymore, which makes absolutely no sense to me. I drank in bars where guys would take a piss against the wall. Apparently they can still do that, but they can't smoke in there. They were full of smoke, and they had that wonderful used booze urine smell that I salivate still. I love that smell. Sometimes if I'm in a cranky mood, I'll go buy one of those joints, open the door, take a hit off of that, and it just perks me up for the rest of the day. But I'm fascinated by the quality of people who drank in there. There were like CEOs of really big companies. There were admirals in the Air Force. There were bank presidents. There were neurosurgeons. I mean, that's what they said they were, but we weren't sitting around having conversations like, well, what do you prefer, the red mouthwash or the green? What's your preference, Chantilly or Aquavelva? I mean, we weren't having those kinds of conversations, so it doesn't occur to me I'm living any different than anybody else. I think I drink because I want to drink. I don't know that I don't have a choice. I don't know that at 13 years old I put alcohol into an alcoholic body. And from that day on, I had no choice. I think I drink because I wanted to drink. I had an opportunity to go to college. I went to San Diego State. I graduated from San Diego State with a 3.8 grade point average. In retrospect, I can tell you I'm a chronic, hopeless, helpless alcoholic. I'm a blackout drinker. I'm drinking every day. And I graduated from college with a 3.8 grade point average. That almost killed me when I got here because I told you I was too smart to be an alcoholic. Nobody with a 3.8 grade point average could possibly be an alcoholic. I stayed at San Diego and took classes for a master's degree. I'm one of those people, I'm doing something well. I want to keep doing it. Apparently, I do school well. So I stayed and took classes for a master's degree. I left San Diego because I had taken all the classes San Diego State has to offer. My disease manifests itself in rationalization, justification, and denial. No matter what it is I do, I explain to you why I'm doing it. As I'm explaining it to you, I'm hearing it. As I'm hearing it, I'm believing it. And I think I'm leaving San Diego because I've taken all the classes San Diego State has to offer. I don't think I'm leaving because I have a roommate who's a little annoyed with me. And here's the thing with my roommate. Even in the height of my alcoholism, even as the worst alcoholic, I've always had a tremendous amount of compassion. And I'm in a bar drinking, and some guy says to me something that the guys that drank in the bars that I drank in have very little creativity. If this offends you, I don't know, talk to your sponsor, but they had two basic lines. My wife doesn't understand, and I have no place to stay tonight. That was typically the end of their dialogue. So some guy would come on to me with one of those lines. I have a tremendous amount of compassion. So I would say, listen, I'll take you home with me, but I don't want to talk to you again until the bar closes. So the bar would close. Being a lady of my word, I would take this guy home with me. We'd get to my house, I'd send him into the bedroom over here on the right, telling him I had to go to the bathroom. He'd go into the bedroom on the right, I would go into my bedroom on the left, and I had just sent him in with my roommate. Now, lots of times that was okay with her. Lots of times she didn't mind at all. Other times, within a matter of minutes, there'd be all this banging on my bedroom door, which I had, of course, locked. I have 7 o'clock classes. I've got to get some rest. And if it would have always been all right or never been all right, I'd have been okay. But she was so inconsistent, you'd have drank if you lived with her. She was so inconsistent. And I don't think I'm leaving because she's annoyed with me. I don't think I'm leaving because I have one more drunk driving assault charge pending. Another resentment I got in Alcoholics Anonymous, I found out here you can get arrested for a single charge of drunk driving. I never knew that. I always got arrested for drunk driving assault. And it had something to do with how I got out of the car. And here's the thing. I'm driving down the street. The light comes on behind me. I pull over. The officer walks up. Now, the first thing I do is slam my car door open. My intent is to knock him in the private parts. Men are a little fussy about their private parts. So as the door's flying open, he jumps back to protect himself. And when he jumps back, it's really a good thing for me because now he's far enough away that I can get him in focus. And I think, one of him, one of me. One of him, one of me, I think I can take him. One of him, one of me, I think I'll try. And I go for him. And it was a really good fight. I was a lot younger then, but it was a good fight for a couple of minutes. But I wouldn't remember that back at the car, he had a friend. And the friend had a radio. And the friend would call some more friends. And pretty soon it'd be two or three of them, one of me. It's not fair anymore. I say, uncle, and they take me away. And the next time the light comes on behind me, I pull over. The officer walks up. I slam my car door open, try and knock him in the private parts. He jumps back to protect himself. He gets far enough away and get him in focus, and I think, one of him, one of me. One of him, one of me, I think I can take him. One of him, one of me, I think I'll try, and I go for him. Good fight for a couple of minutes, but I wouldn't remember the friend, the radio, and the friend's friend. And pretty soon it'd be four or five of them, one of me. It's not fair anymore. He's uncle, and he'd take me away. I didn't do that once or twice. I did that 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 times. Never remembered the friend, the radio, and the friend's friend. And that's the insanity of my disease. The insanity of my disease is I do the same thing over and over, and I think the results are going to be different. This time it's a fair fight. This time I'm going to take him. When you get out of the car like that, they attach an assault charge. They don't even care that they won the fight, drunk driving assault, drunk driving assault. And I don't know if it was a good thing or a bad thing, but I drank during a time when the state of California didn't get their underwear in such a knot about drunk driving. I understand they're pretty testy about it now, but I never really had any. Well, they took my license from me, but you don't really need that to drive a car. I never really had any consequences. I'd pay an attorney $1,000, which was a lot of money, but he'd write a letter, he'd make a phone call, that'd be the end of it. I'd never hear any more about it. But one time I had two pending at the same time, and my attorney was nervous. And I think if your attorney's nervous, you should worry about it. So I'm sitting in a bar worrying about the fact that my attorney's nervous. I just struck up a conversation with this guy sitting next to me, and as luck would have it, he worked in a mortuary. And I came up with a plan. I think we come up with really good plans really quickly. Now, the problem for me is typically my solution is worse than the original problem. Which is why at 36 years sober, I am still actively sponsored. Because still today, my solution typically is worse than the original problem. But I didn't have a sponsor then, and I was sitting next to this guy, and he worked in this mortuary. So we went over the mortuary. We got a death certificate. We put my name on the top of it. We filled out all the pertinent information. We forged a doctor's signature, and we sent it to the court. Because they can't expect a lot from you if you're dead. I called my attorney and told him he didn't need to worry. He didn't worry. I didn't worry. Nobody worried for, I don't know what it was, 30, 60, 90, 100 days. I don't know what it was. And the light came on behind me again. And this time the judge wanted to see me. And I didn't know why. He never wanted to see me before. But you know what? I'm game. I'll go. And I'll never forget him looking at me. He said, "Miss Ochoa, tell me, how is it a dead person is standing in my court?" And I shrugged my shoulders, and with all sincerity, I said, "I don't know. Bad luck." And that's what I thought it was. It was bad luck. It was circumstances and conditions. It was the cops. It was you and they and them. It was a lot of things. It never occurred to me it had anything to do with drinking. It never occurred to me. I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. I didn't know that I didn't have a choice. I didn't know that at 13 years old, I put alcohol into an alcoholic body, and from that day on, I had no choice. I left San Diego because I'd taken all the classes San Diego State has to offer. I was offered a job in Chico, California, which is about as far north as you can get. I loaded everything I owned into my car. I took beer, I took booze, and I headed north. I got to Santa Ana, which isn't the place you want to shoot for, but I got to Santa Ana, I was out of booze, and I was thirsty. I pulled off the freeway of a sense I could find the sleaziest bar in town without even looking for it. I pulled into this place. It was full of smoke. It had that wonderful used booze smell. Willie Nelson was singing on the jukebox, and I knew I was home. That's as far north as I ever got, 88 miles from where I started from. Alcohol had become my mother, my father, my God, my friend, my lover, my companion, my support. And at some point it had turned, and I've always believed it was in the middle of my first drink. At some point it had turned and began to strip me of self-esteem, self-worth, decency, integrity, honesty, pride, all the things we have going for us as human beings. And long before I got to you, it had taken it all. Long before I got to you, alcohol controlled every area of my life. Where I would live, where I would work, the people I would run with, and eventually the people I would run from. And I didn't have a clue. I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. I had an opportunity to go into the profession of my choice. I rose very quickly to the top, and I gave that up for one more drink. I was in the newspaper business, and we often gave awards, and we often won awards. And many, many times I would come out of a blackout in a room full of people holding an award, not knowing if I was giving it or receiving it. And I would say thank you, and I would sit down, and then they'd elbow me and tell me I was presenting it to the Kiwanis Club. And I'd have to get up and start over again. And the only thing I've wanted to do since I was in the fourth grade, and I gave it up for one more drink. If it came between you and a drink, I took a drink. A job and a drink, I took a drink. A career and a drink, I took a drink. Anything and a drink, I took a drink. And I gave up my profession and choice for one more drink. And at 26 years old, I got pulled over one more time. And in 1975, the state of California was starting to get really fussy about people barreling down the freeway at 80 miles an hour, blowing something in the breathalyzer above their grade point average. And I got pulled over one more time, and I was doing the field sobriety test, and I was doing good. I, in fact, mentioned to the officer I thought I was doing A-plus work. Because I'm the kind of person, I get released from jail, I get the arrest report, I read it, I find out where I made my mistake so I can practice that part so that next time I'll get that part right. And I always knew there'd be a next time. I always had a very high-profile job. The cops were always looking for me. They knew what I drove. They knew what I drove if I had my car, a company car, your car, a stolen car. They always knew what I drove, and they were always looking for me. So I practiced field sobriety tests a lot. By what I pray God was the last one I was doing an A-plus job. I knew touch your finger to your nose means this. It doesn't mean that. I know how to walk heel to toe. Today I could stand on one foot for 45 minutes. I am good. I am good at field sobriety test. And at the end of the test, the officer asked me to say the ABCs backwards. Well, the time before I had responded with, well, I can't even do that sober. Well... Now, I had just confessed, he took me away. So on what I pray God was the last one, when he asked me to say the ABCs backwards, I said, okay, and I turned around.
Oh, no!
See, you think it was funny. He wasn't amused at all. I was turned around, he cuffed me, took me to Orange County Jail, and he put me in a cell with criminals. I mean, real criminals. There were like prostitutes in there. There were burglars, women who had been arrested for beating their husband, which I don't think should be a crime, but in California they lock you up for it. And I knew I didn't belong there, so I tried to organize a prison break. I came up with a simple plan, and I explained it very slowly to the criminals. Easy, easy plan. We're going to get our coffee cups. We're going to bang them on the bars. When the marshal comes to see what's going on, I'm throwing my arm around your neck. We're getting your keys, and we're getting out of here. I explained it slowly, and I heard something I was to hear in Alcoholics Anonymous. One of those criminals looked at me and she said, why don't you sit down and shut up? I said, fine, then y'all stay, but I'm getting out of here. I was going like a madwoman on those bars. Couple problems with styrofoam cups. The first one is they don't make a lot of noise. Second one is the bars have a tendency to eat them up. The bars ate them up, and it got to my knuckles, and it got painful. I sat down, and I shut up. I got released on an OR. I went to court on that charge. I was 26 years old. I was drunk in court that morning. It's the only way I went to court. It's the only way I went to work, the laundromat, the grocery store. It's the only way I did anything. I stood there drunk in court that morning. I had the public defender standing next to me. The day of the $1,000 attorney was gone, and I was drunk. And because the state of California was starting to get upset about drunk driving, and because of my past record, I was being sentenced to 10 years in prison. In the middle of sentencing me, the expression on the judge's face changed, and the tone of his voice got different. And I knew he was as surprised at what he was saying as I was at what I was hearing. Because he looked at me and he said, I know this won't work for you, but I'm going to offer you one more chance. And he offered me an alternative. And part of that alternative was meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I wish I could tell you, I took the alternative. I came here. I heard the 12 steps. I knew they were the solution to the problems of my life. I worked them all in the first week and skyrocketed to recovery. And actually, if my friend Mary wasn't here, I would tell you that story. But but that's not my story. I stood and thought about it. I have a son as a direct result of my alcoholism. I never wanted to be a mother. I found out that is not adequate birth control. I didn't like him. He didn't do anything. He wet and he cried. You think at 8 months old he could get a little part-time job. And I didn't like him, but I was willing to use him that morning. I told the judge he couldn't put me in jail. I was a single parent, and I was self-supporting through my own contributions. And he told me he put my son in a foster home because I was an unfit mother. And I knew I was a lot of things, but I did not believe I was an unfit mother. I had that kid with me every day of the week, whether he wanted to be with me or not. And my son was to spend the first 11 months of his life in one of those plastic things that you put kids in when you don't want to touch them. And not the fancy ones like they have today, but the ones that look like little plastic bathtubs. He was to spend the first 11 months of his life sitting in one of those on a pool table in a smoke-filled bar. But I believe because I had him with me made me a fit mother. And my son was going to a foster home, and I was going to prison. And Bill writes something in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, something to this effect. It says something like, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis. And Bill goes on to say, this is not always an easy choice for us. If you're new here this morning, I want you to hear it. This has not ever been an easy choice for any of us, to be doomed to an alcoholic death. And I don't think by alcoholic death, Bill means have the decency to lay down and let him put dirt on your face. I think the alcoholic death that Bill talks about is to continue to live in the incomprehensible demoralization, to continue to live in the despair, to continue to live dreaming dreams and planning plans and not being able to get off the bar stool to get it done. I think the alcoholic death that Bill talks about is when we promise the people we love that we're not going to do it again. And we mean that promise with every fiber of our body, and we promise we're not going to do it again, and then we do it again. And that look in their eye, that look that says, why did you do it? You promised you weren't going to do it. Why'd you do it? I think that's the alcoholic death that Bill talks about, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis. And I think that's the decision I was being asked to make that morning, but I didn't have a clue. And I had that morning what I know this morning was a moment of clarity. I knew, as drunk as I was in that courtroom that morning, I knew that if I went to jail one more time, I would either die in the institution or I'd become institutionalized for life. And I didn't know why I knew it, but I knew it. And I took the alternative, and I left the courtroom, and I drank for 3 more months. In retrospect, I can tell you I didn't drink a greater quantity. Physically, it would have been impossible to drink a greater quantity of alcohol. But I drank with a sense of urgency and a desperation that I had never known. And on October 4th, 1975, I was granted a gift. And I didn't even know I had gotten a gift that day. That day, I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't know what ANA was. I thought it was something like the PTA or Parents Without Partners, and a lot of days it is. But as far as I know, I had never heard the words Alcoholics Anonymous before. I had no idea what you people were going to do to me or for me. And that first meeting was a speaker meeting. I don't know who talked that night, but I heard 2 things. I heard we don't drink between meetings. Well, I quickly looked around and didn't see any of you drinking in the meeting. And I thought, if you're not drinking in the meeting and you don't drink between the meetings, when do you drink? And I don't know how that impacts other newcomers, but it made me incredibly nervous. I could not understand why the judge sent me to a place where people didn't drink. I would have understood if he sent me to the Sears School of Safe Driving. I did not understand why he sent me to a place where people didn't drink. And the other thing I heard was that the answers were in that book, Alcoholics Anonymous. So after the meeting, I stole the book. That's why when they said somebody stole the books, I clapped. I'm like, yes. I I can't tell you how irritated I was. I went home and read the book. Not only could I not find the answers in that book, I couldn't even find the questions. I thought, oh, dear God, I've stolen the wrong book, and I'm a thief. It's humiliating for a thief to have stolen the wrong book. Now, I don't know I'm a thief. My sponsor told me I was a thief. I think it's important you have a sponsor. I think it's critical you have a sponsor who's not as emotionally involved in your life as you are. It irritates me at times, but she has a whole different perspective of my life. And here's the thing. I'm in a bar drinking. I pick up, the bar closes. I pick up the keys. I go find the car. I'm driving myself home. My sponsor in the San Diego police think this is Grand Theft Auto. I think it's alternative transportation. I just need to get home. Rationalization, justification, and denial, no matter what I do. I come to your house and I shop.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
So my sponsor thinks I'm a thief. I don't know. But anyway, so I decide that I'm going to go back to the court to tell the judge he made this hideous error in sending me to Alcoholics Anonymous. But before I go tell him that, I better go get the answer book. So Wednesday, with 4 days of sobriety, you see, I've been given the gift of sobriety. October 4th, I didn't drink. And I don't know why I didn't drink that day. I didn't plan to not drink that day. I didn't know A&A was about not drinking. I had never tried to not drink. I had never tried to control my drinking. I always just drank. And that day, I didn't drink. It was a gift from a gentle and a loving God, because I didn't ask for it. I didn't plan it. I didn't even know I had it. Wednesday, with 4 days of sobriety, I went to my second meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was a small discussion meeting. And in that meeting, I heard, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it. And I looked around the room, and I looked around the room, and I looked around the room. I could not figure out what it was you had that was so hot that I should be willing to go to any length to get it. I mean, look at the person next to you. Unless you're sleeping with them, what is it? I mean, I could not figure it out, and then I saw him. And I truly believe there's a him for each of us. This guy was a skinny little fellow. He was bald-headed. He wore baggy pants, not like the kids do today. I work with kids. I work with kids that wear pants that have absolutely no relationship to their body size. His weren't that baggy, but they were baggy. He had tennis shoes on with no shoelaces, and he nodded out during the meeting. And I quickly assessed the situation. I figured he was shooting heroin. Folks who shoot heroin, not out, and I can probably do this thing and not drink if I could shoot a little heroin. So I found out where he worked. The next day I snuck down to his office and I said, Dick, I have to do this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous to stay out of jail, and I don't know how to do it. And he told me if I would go to meetings and read the book and talk to other alcoholics and not drink. So I guarantee you, you won't get drunk. And if you don't get drunk, your life will get different. And I'm grateful he told it to me that way. He didn't tell me my life would get better. He didn't tell me my family life would get better, my job life would get better, my finances would get better, my sex life would get better. He didn't tell me any of it would get better, and I'm grateful, because none of it has. So it's a little hope for the newcomer. But it's all gotten different. And as I stand here this morning, I can tell you from the top of my head to the tip of my toes, I have never had it so good. See, I don't know good from bad for me. I'm going through something I think is good for me, and it generally turns out to be bad for me. And I'm going through something I think is bad for me, and it generally turns out to be good for me. I don't know good from bad for me. But I know different. And every area of my life is different than the day I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have never had it so good. I've been in pain in the last 36 years. Life is painful sometimes, not just for alcoholics, but for people. Life is sometimes painful. And when I go through those painful times, I'm rather dramatic, so I always refer to it as the dark night of the soul. Unless, of course, you're going through it, then I just tell you to get over yourself. But in those times, if I don't drink and don't die and don't drink and don't die, I've gotten far enough beyond it to, in retrospect, see that every time I thought my life was falling apart, what was really happening is it was falling together. And it had to be exactly that way for God to move me to where he had me be. See, I'm the kind of person, I get content. I can tell you this, right here, right now, my life is fabulous. Right here, right now, I couldn't even think of another single thing to ask for. And I get content, and I dig a little rut, and I decorate it. But there's a God who has a plan bigger than this for me. And sometimes to get me out of my rut, God's got to kick me in the butt to get me out of the rut, to move me to where he'd have me be. There is so much more that God has planned for me. But right here, right now, I think this is fabulously enough. And I believe that old man. I hadn't believed another human being in a long time. My perspective of my life, and this is just my perspective, my perspective is that people let me down all my life. People hurt me and they disappointed me. My parents told me they loved me any more of their love and I'd have died. Their love was physically, emotionally, and spiritually abusive. People said they would be there for me and they weren't. I remember consciously making a decision as a very small child. I don't want to be hurt anymore. I don't want to be hurt anymore. And I began to build a brick wall to keep you out. I began to build a brick wall to keep you out because I just don't want to be hurt anymore. And alcohol didn't allow me to come out and play. Alcohol just made it okay for me to be back there. And when you live behind a wall like that, you don't believe and you don't trust. And I hadn't believed another human being in a very long time. But I believed that old man that morning. I didn't know why then, but I know why this morning. I believed him because of the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. One alcoholic talking to another. One alcoholic talking to another goes through that brick wall. And I believed that old man. I had the book, so I'd open it to the chapter and read, "Most of us are unwilling to admit we are real alcoholics." I'd say amen and close the book, and that was reading the book. I'd go down to the Canyon Club in Laguna Beach where they have AA meetings. I'd have a cup of coffee. On the way out, I'd say hi, Jim, to the manager. He'd say hi, Patty. That was talking to another alcoholic. My court program said I had to go to 2 meetings a week. I thought that was really obsessive, but I was willing to go to any lengths to stay out of jail. And the only thing I did right is I didn't drink. And I didn't drink, and I didn't drink, and I didn't drink. And I pray God happens to everybody who's new what happened to me. Like I said, I've been in pain in the last 36 years, but I have never been in the kind of pain that I was in 8.5 months away from my last drink. The pain of not drinking and not recovering. The pain of not drinking and not recovering is the greatest pain I've ever been in. Because you see, I sat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the men and women shared exactly the way the book. They said to share about what it used to be like, what happened and what it's like now. And when you shared what it used to be like, your alcoholism touched mine. And you shared what it used to be like, and your alcoholism touched mine, and yours touched mine, and yours touched mine, and yours touched mine. And 8.5 months away from my last drink, my alcoholism woke up. And I was in the greatest pain I've ever been in. And that pain drove me to my knees. And on my knees, I admitted to my innermost self that I was alcoholic. And the book says this is the first step in recovery. Selfish and self-centered, that's what walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think the greatest prayer that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous, the most powerful prayer we have, is the seven-step prayer. And the seven-step prayer says something to this effect. It says, take all of me, good and bad. How powerful is that for an alcoholic of my nature? Take it all, good and bad. I don't have to judge it anymore. Is it a good thing, a bad thing, a right thing, a wrong thing, or my personal favorite, my will or God's will? We have the my will or God's will debate in Orange County all the time. And here's the way I look at my will. I think God's will is like the GPS in my car. I set her to where I want to go, and I start driving. And then she'll say to me, in 200 feet, turn right. Well, in 200 feet, I have alcoholism. I don't have alcohol-wasm. So in 200 feet, I think, I don't want to turn right. So I turn left. And my GPS doesn't say, Patio, you are the worst driver in Southern California. You are just a lousy driver. Nope, she just reconfigures the route. Doot, 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 doot. And then pretty soon she'll say, in 175 feet, turn left. Well, 175 feet comes, and I'm thinking, nope, don't want to turn left. I want to go straight, and I go straight. And she doesn't scream at me, get out of the car, you're a lousy driver, you're no darn good. She is kind of like an Al-Anon. She just reconfigures the route. And eventually, I get to where I'm going. And that's how God's will is like, God doesn't put an opportunity up. And if I make an unhealthy choice, God doesn't say, you are a lousy member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You are no darn good. What are you doing in AA anyway? Get out. Nope, God just puts up another opportunity. And if I make an unhealthy choice, he doesn't scream at me and tell me I have to leave AA and all the women you sponsor should fire your ass. He just puts up another opportunity, and that's God's will for me. But I don't have to judge it, good thing, right thing, bad thing, wrong thing, God's will. I don't take it all. Leave me with this. Leave me with what I need to be of service to you and my fellows. How powerful is that? Selfish and self-centered. That's what walked through the doors. Here's what I've done. Almost nothing. I admitted to my innermost self that I was alcoholic. I came to believe the people in AA were telling me the truth. I made a decision to do what you said you had done. I wrote about my favorite topic, me. I bored somebody for about an hour and a half having to listen to it. And as a result of those simple things, all I care about is being of service to God and my fellows. How powerful is that? And I think too many people leave before they give themselves the opportunity. Too many people make it way too complicated that they never really get there. Steps 8 and 9 for me are conventional ways of getting rid of conventional guilt. I felt guilty because I was guilty. I did a lot of things to a lot of people for one more drink. If it came between you and a drink, I took a drink. And it wasn't just about saying sorry. I'd said sorry all my life. Sorry, sorry, sorry. And then I'd do it again and get caught. Sorry, sorry, sorry. And then I'd do it again and get caught. So it wasn't about saying sorry. It was about living my life differently. And I don't know how to do that. This is the only way I know how to live. But you do. And so I come to AA. And you talk about what it's like today. And you allow me to take your experience out in the world and live it. And it becomes my experience. And I take your experience and live it, and it becomes my experience. And I take your experience and your experience. I am the woman I am this morning because the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous have continued to share what it's like for them today and have allowed me to take their experience out in the world and live it. One of the things my sponsor at the time had an elementary school education, and she got really obsessed with my master's degree. She wanted me to finish it. She nagged at me like a little chihuahua dog. Because I'm a good starter. I start a lot of stuff. I'm a horrible finisher, but I'm a great starter. And she got her little chihuahua teeth into my master's degree, which I don't even want to finish because I've drank myself out of my profession and choice. I still, 36 years later, can't work in my profession in Orange County. And she wants me to finish a degree, and I don't want to finish it. And I'm probably going to have to take classes, and I don't have time, and nag, nag, nag. And the only reason I did it, and I know the women I sponsor don't have this complaint, but I just do it to shut her up. And so I call San Diego, and I get the administration on the phone, and I explain to this woman that I need to finish my master's degree. And she puts me on hold, and she comes back and says that, she said, Miss Ochoa, our records indicate that you have a master's degree. And I said, no, I need to take oral exams. I never did it. And she's insisting I have my degree. So now I don't want the dang thing, but now I'm obsessed with it. So I'm calling all over San Diego to get a hold of the guy who's head of my master's committee. And I finally get a hold of him, and I explain my dilemma. And he said, Patty, you have your master's degree. And I said, but I had to take 2-day oral exams. He said, you did. And I said, well, how was I? He said, you were brilliant. I said, well, of course. And I called my sponsor and told her how she had humiliated me one more time. And I have friends who actually think I should call around. They're pretty sure I have a doctorate somewhere. But I got right. I finished up all my unfinished business. I became a good daughter, a good mother, a good sister. I finished up all my unfinished business, and for the first time in my life, it was enough, and it was exactly the right kind. I'm a chronic malcontent. It's never enough. It's never the right kind. But it doesn't mean I don't want more. I'm a pig, and I want more, and so I continue to come to the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. 10, 11, and 12 are the recovery steps. They're the steps that allow me to continue to come here, to sit in the middle of you and continue to grow. 10 says the process is powerful. Keep using it. Keep writing about it, talking about it. Ask God to remove the defect, make amends if necessary, and then turn your attention to somebody you can help. What is it I can do for you? If you want this roundup to be yours, get a job. If you want your home group to be yours, get a job. Don't just go sit in a meeting and take up a chair. If you want it to be yours, get a job. I've always had a job in Alcoholics Anonymous. Coffee maker, by the way, is the most important commitment in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know that because they made me coffee maker in my Monday night meeting, and I came and We have a big old coffee pot. I filled it up with water. I opened up this big old can of coffee. I dumped it all in the basket and put the lid on, plugged it in. It took forever to perk. Finally, some guy came and he poured himself a big cup of coffee, took a big old jolt. His eyeballs rolled back in his head. And the next person took a big jolt. His eyeballs rolled back. Pretty soon, they were taking half a cup and sipping. Nobody said who made this swill. Nobody said anything bad about my coffee. And at the end of the meeting, the secretary made announcements, and he said, you know, we've discovered Coffee Maker, the most important commitment in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's so important that we're giving Patty an assistant. And they assigned me an assistant, and the next week, my assistant and I showed up, and I filled up the pot, he opened the can, he measured it into the little basket. We plugged it in and went bloop, 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 bloop. And one more time, you didn't tell me what to do. You showed me what to do. You have never told me what to do. You have always shown. I took a first step and admitted my life was unmanageable. If I believe mine's unmanageable, why would I think I could manage yours? You have continued to show me what to do. Step 11 says, I'm very naive. My prayer in the morning is very simply, thy will be done. And I truly believe the rest of the day is God's business. My job is to not drink, show up, and live life to the fullest. The rest of it is God's business. My prayer at night is a little scary, or offer to anybody who'd like to use it. I guarantee you, if you use this prayer for 90 days, it will change your life. My prayer at night is, dear God, please have people treat me tomorrow exactly the way I treated people today. And when I know I'm going to say that prayer tonight, it will hold me in good stead. I don't flip people off on the freeway anymore. I still count, but I don't announce the number of items in the 10-item or less line at the grocery store. And I don't live my life so much out of virtue as I know I'm going to say that prayer. I challenge you to use it. It will change your life. And step 12 is the greatest gift you've ever given me, an opportunity to take a little of my past and give it to another alcoholic, to look into the eyes of another alcoholic and say, honey, take my hand, come with me, sit in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you don't have to live that way a day at a time. I need to tell you I've done everything wrong in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm very judgmental. I'm incredibly critical. I've slept with newcomers. I'd do it again in a minute if I had. But the thing that I've done right is I haven't drank. If I don't like the way I live today, if I don't drink, I can choose to live differently tomorrow. If I take a drink, I have no choices. I want to tell you a little bit about what it's like today before Monday rolls around. My son was 11 months old when I got sober. I brought him to AA with me because I didn't know what to do with him. I brought him to meetings and you'd hold him, and after the meeting you'd give him back to me, and I'd bring him to the next meeting and you'd hold him, and after the meeting you'd give him back to me. And everything my son knows, he learned from the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous. You taught him how to be kind and loving and gentle. You also taught him how to con and manipulate, and I've never been thrilled with that, but apparently you have to take the good with the bad. And my son's been to more women than more meetings than most of the women I sponsor. And I share that with you for this reason. If just sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous were enough, my son would have never had a problem. But my son had a journey that alcoholic men go on. He went to places that no human being should go, and he did things that no human being should do. And I got in the ring with his disease. My roommate one time told me she found marijuana in his room. I said, oh, it must belong to one of his friends. The school was calling me, telling me his grades were slipping. I said, you know, he's just one of those kids that an education's not important. It'll be important to him in his early 20s. Rationalization, justification, and denial, I was making excuses for him. And God did for me what I could not do for myself. God won't do for me what I can do for myself. He won't send me money in the mail, because apparently I'm able to work, but God will do for me what I can't do for myself. And my son came home, he was 17 years old. The bags under his eyes were down to his knees. And he walked into the house, and I said these words, which I would have never said to my son. I said, Patrick, are you loaded? And he looked at me and he said, no. He said, I'm just tired. He'd heard me rationalizing it for years. And I said, then you have to make a choice. You can either smoke marijuana or you can live in my house, but you can't do both. And he went into his room. And 10 minutes later, he came out with a backpack over his shoulder. And he had made a choice. Intellectually, understand the choice. I have made it over and over and over. If it came between you and a drink, I took a drink. Anything in a drink, I took a drink. But when my son made that choice, my heart broke. If you're sitting here this morning and you think your drinking's only bothering you, it's not hurting anybody else. I'm only hurting myself. I want you to know this. If you have a mother, there is somebody whose heart you're breaking. My son made a choice and he walked out of his house and my heart broke. And I sat on the couch. I was 17 years sober. I had no idea what to do. I could drink or I could kill myself. That was the only way I could figure out to get rid of the pain that I felt when my son made that choice. I could drink or I could kill myself. And I sat on the couch thinking about it. My experience is this. It doesn't matter what you think about. It matters what you do. Because I didn't do anything. I just sat on my couch thinking. And in the morning, my phone rang, and it was one of the women I sponsor. And I don't know about the people you sponsor, but mine never start out with, "How are you?" And I answered the phone, and she started telling me about her problem, whatever it was, la 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 la. And she finally took a breath, and I said, "Look, I'll meet you at the club. We'll go to the meeting, and then we'll talk about it." And I went to the club, and we went to the meeting, and then we talked about it. And it didn't eliminate the pain, but it decreased it just a tiny bit, just enough that I could take one more right action and one more right action. And my son was out with his disease for a long, long time. And he moved to San Francisco. He called me one day and he said, "Mom, I had an accident. I need 140 stitches. It's going to cost $120. I said, "Oh, my God, tell me the address of the hospital. I'll send a check." He said, "Oh, no, they need cash." And I said, "Well, I'm in Southern California. You're in Northern California. I don't know how to do that." And he taught me how to wire money. And I wired the money, and about a week later, he called me. He'd walked through a plate glass window, and he needed stitches, and he needed $120, and I wired the money. And I wired the money, and I wired. He'd call me collect at work. This is a nice touch. I work in treatment. He'd call me collect at work, and I'd say, "Patrick, go to AA," and I'd hang up on him. And then he'd call collect again, and I'd say, "Patrick, go to AA," and he said, "I'm not going to be Patio's son," and I hung up on him. And then he'd call me collect again, and I'd swear at him, and hang up, and then by this time, four or five people at my work know he's calling, and so I send the money. And I had four or five MoneyGram stores going at the same time because I didn't want the 17-year-old clerk to know I was sending the money one more time. And I was in the ring with his disease. I was getting beat up bad. Whenever I get in the ring with alcohol, I lose, whether I'm fighting it because I'm drinking it or I'm fighting it because you're drinking it. I went to Al-Anon. I love Al-Anon. I went to Al-Anon. And the Al-Anon people said to me finally, they said, "Patty, you are an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Please go back there. You're giving us a bad name." Because and I did everything wrong. I did everything wrong. The thing that I did right is I came here and I told you. I came here and I told you. And God bless the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous. They'd say things to me like, "Patty, you're 24, 25, 26 years sober. Aren't you embarrassed to be telling us this? I want you to know this. If I am ever too embarrassed to come tell you the truth, I'm going to be drunk. And I don't want to drink anymore." So I come here and I tell you the truth. And on October 23rd, 2002, my son had moved back to Southern California. He called me one more time. And he said, "Mom, I need help." And God did for me what I could not do for myself. Because I said to my son, I said, "Patrick, I can't help you anymore. If I can stay where you are, and I'll send somebody. If I go, I'm going to kill you." And I called a man in Alcoholics Anonymous, and thank God I called somebody who understood the traditions. Because when I called him, he didn't say, "Tell the boy to call me." He said, "Where is he?" And I gave him the address of that motel, and he went and picked up a newcomer, and they got my son, and they brought him to the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for almost 10 years now, you have done with him what you have done with me for 36 years. You haven't told him what to do. You've shown him what to do. You didn't tell him to greet. You greeted with him. You didn't tell him to set up. You set up with him. And for a little over almost 10 years, my son has been an active member in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And and he and I shared a pitch one Saturday night. He was a 10-minute speaker, and I was the main speaker. And when he was talking, he talked about the pain of growing up without a father. I've been a single parent his whole life, and I never knew not having a father caused him that kind of pain. But he shared about the pain that night in the meeting. And as he's talking, he looks at these 200 people, and he said, "But my mother's a blackout drinker, and I may never know who my father is." And I thought, "Oh, my God, you just outed me as a slut." Ha, ha, ha. And it was one of my proudest moments. And those of us who are parents, I don't think we ever rocked our infant child, looked him in the eye and said, oh, honey, one day my proudest moment is when you and I share a podium at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought about that day in that courtroom, seconds and inches, as Norm Alpe used to say, seconds and inches. If I'd have made a different choice in that courtroom that morning, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis, if I'd have made a different choice that morning, I'd have missed it. And a couple of years later, because my son's an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, he chaired ACUPA when it was in Orange County. And I'll tell you what, you guys think this is enthusiastic. I challenge you to go to SoCalipa in October. It's October 5th. It's going to be in Irvine, SoCalipa4.org. You can register online. Those young people have so much. It's like an IV of enthusiasm that they have. And after this weekend, by October, you're going to need a little jolt of it to be ready for next July. So, and you don't have to be young. Clearly, I go, and I'm not a spring chicken. But so calipop4.org, register online. But my son was chair of ACUPA that year, and they had asked me to be the Saturday night speaker. And my son introduced the speaker that Saturday night. He said, I want to introduce tonight's speaker, my mother and my hero. And tears rolled down my face, and I thought, how do you get there from where I was on October 4th, 1975? How do you get there? Except through the power and the magic of the 12 Steps to Recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. And on November 29th, 2006, I was in a hospital room in South Coast Medical Center when my grandson was born. And I was photographing the birth of my grandson because he taught me here to have a job. If you want it to be yours, have a job. So I was photographing the birth of my grandson, and at one point the doctor looked at me and he said, this is a good shot. And I know a little about the female anatomy, and I'm thinking, no, no, this is not a good... And just about then, my grandson's head was born. The doctor turned the head, and I looked into the eyes of God. And I looked behind him at his mother, and I looked into the eyes of God, and I looked behind her at my son, and I looked into the eyes of God. And I realized at that moment, for 30 years, you have allowed me to stand here and look into the eyes of God. I realized at that moment that for 31 years, you have the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous have removed one brick at a time. You have removed that brick wall that I have built between me and you. My grandson was born, he walked into my heart, and he changed my life. You have taught me how to love in Alcoholics Anonymous, but unless you're a grandparent, you cannot understand the kind of love that came when that little boy walked into my heart. He's 5 and a half, he's never done a single thing wrong. I get to pick him up every Tuesday. Every Tuesday we go to Old McDonald's. I pick him up every Tuesday. And one Monday my son called me and he was going to be late. He said, Mom, can you pick Eden up from school? And at preschool, they charge you like $200 a minute if you're late. So I went that Monday to pick him up, and I walked in and he comes running across the room screaming. He screams grandma when he sees me. He runs across the room. He jumps into my arms. He said, Grandma, you might be a little confused. It's not Tuesday. And on his fifth birthday, his mother had a bounce house birthday party for him, and we got there early, and he wanted me in the bounce house. I'm not the bounce house kind of girl, but he wanted me in the bounce house, so I got in the bounce house, and he wanted to teach me how to do a somersault. And it took him a while, but he finally got me to get to do a somersault. And he was so thrilled, he squealed when I finally did the bounce house somersault. And I got out of the bounce house, and some people came, and then I had to get back in the bounce house because he had to show them that I knew how to do a bounce house. And I did it again, and then I got out, and some more people came, and he had me back in the bounce house. And I love this. I would do anything for him. I love him. And if you said to me, Patty, I'll give you a shot at Jack Daniels, give me Eden. There is no way I'm giving you my grandson for a shot at Jack Daniels. I'll give you a quart of Jack Daniels, give me Eden. I'm not giving you my grandson for a quart. I'll give you a case of Jack Daniels. I'll give you a truckload of I'll give you the Jack Daniels plant. I am not giving you my grandson for the Jack Daniels plant. But I can tell you this. If I take one shot of Jack Daniels, I will give him up this quick for the second one. and so I stay in the middle of you. I need you more today than I needed you when I came here. I stay in the middle of you so that I can continue to live a day at a time, walking the journey that we walk here, hand in hand with the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous on a journey that is beyond the wildest imagination of any of us. I stay in the middle of you. When I was 4 days sober, an old man told me if I didn't drink, I wouldn't get drunk. And if I didn't get drunk, my life would get different, and he didn't lie to me. I'm going to end with this story. It's a story of the man that goes to see St. Peter, and he asks St. Peter to show him heaven and hell. And St. Peter takes him to a room, and it says hell on the door, but when they open the door, inside the door, it's a banquet. Tables and tables of food, as much food as you could ever imagine, any kind of food you'd ever want. And the people in that room, amongst all that food, they're starving and they're dying. And the reason that they're hungry is they have those long wooden spoons tied to their hand. And the spoons are just a little too long. They can't quite get the food to their mouth. So they're sitting amongst plenty and they're starving. And that's how I was before I came to you. I was out there amongst plenty and I was starving. Then he took him to a room marked heaven. And in that room was the same scene, tables and tables and tables of food, as much food as you could ever imagine, any kind of food you'd ever want. And the people in that room had those long wooden spoons tied to their hands too. But they were full, and they were happy, and they were content. And the reason was is that one man was taking a spoonful of food, and he was feeding the man across the table. And he was taking a spoonful of food and feeding the person next to him, and she was feeding somebody else. And you don't have to have 36 years or 30 years or 5 years or 1 year. If you got one day, you have something to feed to the man or woman walking through the door. It takes a lot of courage and a lot of strength to continue to choose to recover. I don't have it. Cowards drink and use. I did that on a daily basis for 13 years. It takes a lot of courage and a lot of strength to continue to choose to recover. And I don't have it, but you do. And when we pray this morning, the person on my right will give me a little strength. And the person on my left will give me a little courage. And you give me the courage and strength that I need to continue to choose to recover. And if you got one day, you have something to give to the man or woman sitting next to you. I end with this. I always end with it. I end with it because it's been my experience. And I pray, God, it's your experience. It's a line in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, in chapter 5. It's a line that says, there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Thank you.
Enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.